From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. The website 538 tweeted this morning that primary day yesterday could be remembered as the day that launched some prominent political careers, including 44-year-old Stacey Abrams, the Georgia Democrat, who, if she wins an uphill fight in November, would become the first African-American woman governor, and 33-year-old Houston-area Republican congressional candidate Dan Crenshaw, former Navy SEAL, who wears an eye patch, who, during his campaign, backtracked on calling President Trump's rhetoric hateful.
Meanwhile, the president is getting ready to sign a bill that 33 Democrats crossed the aisle to approve yesterday that repeals some banking regulations put into place after the financial crisis 10 years ago. And of course, as it happens any day, the president keeps tweeting about what he calls the FBI witch hunt and a spy in his campaign. Let's bring in our political strategist, Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Good day.
Great to be with you, Jeremy and Magma.
Yeah, and let's take a listen to the star of the night last night, or one of them. This is Georgia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams in her victory speech.
And I know you know that as our state's rich and complicated history courses through our memories on nights like tonight when the unexpected becomes the truth. It reminds us of who we are.
Jamal, what do you make of last night? And do you think that Abrams has a chance of winning in Georgia?
It's just magnificent. I mean, I've known Stacey Abrams. We actually were in college at the same time. She is a phenomenal leader for the state. And I think what will happen in this election is something we haven't seen in Georgia, which is very different. She is going to both go out and bring new voters to the Democratic Party who maybe are more irregular voters because they'll be inspired by the message she has, and compete particularly among many of the suburban white women that Democrats have been trying for a generation to win. She's going to make a case that she is standing up for them also. And I think that's something, that combination of base voters, swing voters, this new population of voters really matters.
But of course, a primary is different than the general. So, I mean, Alice, is the Republican Party concerned about a candidate like Abrams?
You have to keep in mind, Trump won Georgia by several points, 5 or 6 points, and it's a Republican state. I'm from Atlanta. I born and raised there. And look, I'm old enough to remember when Maynard Jackson was first elected mayor of Atlanta. Now his name's on Hartsfield Airport. It's Atlanta has come a long way, and Georgia has come a long way. And I think this has been a tremendous victory. And I think the great thing that Stacey Abrams did is, she didn't just focus on Democrats or progressives. She really campaigned reaching out to all voters and made a point that she, if elected governor, she would be a governor for all voters. And I saw stories and read stories about her reaching out across the aisle to bring in all people from all political parties. That being said, it will be a difficult general election. Casey Cagle and Brian Kemp, the two Republicans that will be facing off in a primary later, they're strong candidates, and they have tremendous name ID given their current positions, and it will be a fun race to watch. But I at the end of the day, I think the Republican will win out.
Well, Alice,
look, I'll tell you, I worked for Max Cleland in 2002 when he ran for re-election and lost. That was the year Democrats lost the Senate and governor's races and most of the state races down there. And I will tell you, Democrats have been trying to run a playbook for a generation that's based on trying to woo these sort of Zell Miller Democrats over to the side to get them to turn out. And it's been unsuccessful, including Jason Carter in the last election. So we're going to try something new this time in the party in that state, and I think we'll see whether or not it works.
Alice, more broadly, when you look at the results from yesterday, what does it tell you about whether Republican candidates this fall ought to embrace President Trump or not?
Every candidate will look at how Trump polls in their district, specifically when we're talking about the congressional races, even on the more state and local races. They're going to look at how people view Trump. If he's popular in that area, they're going to hug up to him. And if not, they will say that they will be a check and balance on Trump and his administration and his policies. But I think what frustrates voters more than anything is his rhetoric and his tone and his demeanor. So it will be interesting to see how the economy is doing at that time, how the president's popularity and approval rating is as we get closer to November, and if he is successful with some of these policies he's working on, specifically with regard to North Korea, and how the Mueller investigation plays out. I think we're still far out from defining exactly how important he will be. But no one's going to say right now if they're going to hug up to Trump or if they're going to be a check and balance. It's just too early to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Is that true? I mean, I think we saw, you just mentioned Dan Crenshaw, who ran and he backtracked on his opposition to Trump or his criticism of Trump. I'm not sure you can get elected in the modern Republican Party distancing yourself from Donald Trump. That is something you need to do to get through a primary. But then the general election, it's going to be a weight around everyone's necks that runs with Donald Trump. I think that this is a very tough vice for Republicans to be in. And this year we are going to see whether or not Donald Trump can bring anybody else over the finish line, or if his coattails are only for him and his own cronies.
Yeah, let's move on to the rollback of some of the provisions of the Dodd-Frank financial regulation, because it's a really interesting story here. And Jamal, I want to just start with you, because a lot of Democrats joined Republicans to weaken banking rules. Some of those key Democrats are definitely thinking about those large regional banks that maybe want to be free of some of the Dodd-Frank regulations. But I mean, it was only a decade ago that we were on the brink of financial catastrophe. Are you surprised that so many Democrats did join to weaken these banking rules?
I'm never surprised that anything a big business lobby is able to get accomplished in Congress. They are usually able to get something done. But, I heard Barney Frank on NPR earlier, and he was, one of the authors of the original bill. And he said it's not something he would have voted for, but it's not as bad as it could have been. And so Republicans have gone as far as they could. But they didn't fundamentally weaken it, particularly for the biggest banks who have $250 billion or more in assets. In this era where Donald Trump is in business for him and his crony friends, it's hard to find something else that's better.
Alice, you mentioned the Russia investigation. Let's go there next. Leaving the White House this morning, President Trump spoke about his hopes for a big meeting tomorrow that congressional Republicans and Justice Department officials will attend, but not Democrats, to look at secret documents in the FBI's Russia investigation.
What I want is total transparency. Wait, you have to have transparency. Even they probably want transparency because this issue supersedes a party.
Alice, what do you think is going to come out of this meeting?
First of all, Jeremy, let me just say this. I think the investigators in this case are not above reproach. They certainly deserve oversight. And I do think Congress has the authority to provide oversight. And if there are documents that they are entitled to, they should get. But it should be bipartisan. I think Democrats should be allowed to have access to this information as well. The president just said himself in that comment that this isn't about partisanship. If that's the case, just because Republicans were the only ones that asked for this information, I believe Democrats should also be able to have access to it. So if the meeting stays as it is with just Republicans in there, I think the outcome of the meeting won't be quite as fruitful. If Democrats are included in, which it doesn't look like it will be much more helpful. But at the end of the day, the meeting, in my view, will be just another way for Republicans to get together and compare notes and see where we stand. And they will go forth with what they've continued to do, which I think is unfortunate, is undermine and discredit the investigation as opposed to support it and get to the root of what they're looking for is how do we prevent Russia from interfering with our elections.
Well, and Jamal, is that working? I mean, just bringing up all these questions about Mueller, about the investigation constantly on the part of the president.
I've got a shocker, but I'm going to tell you, I think Donald Trump is winning. He is changing the rules of the game. He is muddying the water. We heard recent press reports of him talking very clearly about attacking the media to discredit the media with his voters. He is going after the investigators. He does not care. Donald Trump does not care about any of our political norms. He will not be governed by political norms. He might be governed by the law. We have yet to really test that case, but we know he won't be governed by the norms. Our only a recourse here is that either Bob Mueller is going to find something that is totally damning against him, or the Republicans in Congress, led by the Democrats and perhaps an ailing John McCain, can help save the Republic.
And his point there, he is winning in that he's getting his message directly to his base and his supporters by calling this a witch hunt and spies in his campaign. His voters that will stand by him and go out to vote for him listen to him as opposed to what maybe the media narrative is. And from that standpoint, the president is successful.
Alice, we have a couple seconds. I want to follow up with you on that for 1 second.
Sure.
If everything you're saying about Trump and reaching out to his voters is base is true, I mean, but what does that mean for democratic norms? What does that mean for basic functioning of democracy in this country? I mean, I'm just curious about what you think about that.
No, that's a great question. The reality is he can sit there and try the case as he's currently doing in the court of public opinion, but the real verdict will come when Mueller hands down his investigation. And that's what people – that will be a rude awakening for people if those that have believed this is a witch hunt and the investigation is meritless. If it proves to show some coordination and collusion, which I hope that it doesn't, but if it does, that will be a very, very big black eye on this presidency.
That's Alice
Stewart
and
Jamal
Simmons. That's it. We're done. President Trump is on Long Island today at a roundtable meeting about the MS-13 gang, something he's talked a lot about in the debate about immigration. Meanwhile, in the House, Republican leaders are promising to bring up legislation on immigration next month. House Speaker Paul Ryan had wanted to avoid a contentious debate about the issue heading into the midterms, but he's getting pressure from a group of moderate Republicans who want to find a permanent fix to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. Another more conservative bill would authorize $30 billion for a border wall and end family-based migration, among other things. Joining us now is Larimer County, Colorado Sheriff Justin Smith. He's met with the president on immigration issues. He's also running unopposed for re-election this November. Sheriff, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
And what are you hoping to see out of Washington right now?
Well, Jeremy, the concern that we have oftentimes in our local communities are without sufficient border security, we see crime that comes across the border and ends up in our communities. We recognize that we just need a more secure border. We've got enough problems at home without the issues of human trafficking and drugs coming across our border. So we're looking for some solutions because that really is going to take the federal government. That's not something local communities can address adequately.
Do you think it's worth a compromise, though? Like if there were to be, let's say, a border wall or more security at the border, would it be worth it also to offer a path to citizenship for the so-called dreamers?
You know, for me, Jeremy, that's really not down my alley as far as where my concerns are. My big issue is that we need to assure that there is a better multi-layered approach on those borders. And so, you know, how they get there really isn't something that I put a specific path on. It's the fact that we have to get to a point that the borders are much more secure than we see today.
But you wouldn't be opposed to a solution for the DACA recipients?
Again, I'm just not taking a position on that part. I certainly understand those in Congress who are concerned that there's an amnesty today, border security tomorrow approach that they're not willing to go to, and I certainly understand those concerns.
And how do you address the people who are already in the country illegally?
You know, when we look at that, Jeremy, obviously those issues are almost exclusively a federal responsibility under federal authority. It's a discussion that we have as sheriffs, and we get pushed by folks that want us to do the job of immigration officials. Now, I think there's a big difference that we cooperate with our federal partners in a variety of areas. Certainly immigration is one of those, but we have no authority to enforce immigration laws. So there's a lot of areas that need to be addressed. Certainly one of the big pushes we hear as we talk about the DACA recipients is we can't break up families. But in fairness, those families broke up oftentimes to come over here. And so that argument actually goes both ways.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced earlier this month plans to criminally prosecute everyone entering the U.S. illegally. Here he is.
If you cross the border unlawfully, even a first offense, then we're going to prosecute you. If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law.
Now, in some cases, these children would be housed in military facilities. They could end up in the already overburdened foster system. What do you think about that? That not only would families be separated, but that maybe these kids would end up on military bases?
Well, here's what I know, Jeremy. I know now, talking to the border sheriffs that I work with on a regular basis and doing my own research, that the number of children who are abused as they're brought across that border, the number of women that are raped, the number of individuals who essentially are exploited coming across the border is outrageous when you really research that. And so I think the attorney general is looking at that issue. You know, it's somewhat of a tough love to say, you know what, we've been pretty lax on our borders for quite some time, and it has not solved the problem. It can sound a little difficult to say we're going to enforce the laws that are there, but nothing in what I heard from General Sessions says that he's going to go beyond the laws that are authorized. But I think when we have these discussions, we certainly have to understand the consequences of allowing this to go on, and you have the coyotes bringing people across who are doing terrible things to these individuals. And if it takes a little tough love to put a stop to that, it certainly may be something this country needs to look at.
Well, you call it tough love. Some people are calling it inhumane.
Well, I think inhumane is the number of rapes that go on, the pictures of the rape trees down on the border where they've hung women's undergarments as they've been sexually assaulted.
But that's being done by criminals, not the U.S. government.
And the way to stop those criminals is to secure the border. It's happening because individuals are either seeking their way across the border or being ferried. And again, keep in mind how many times these individuals coming across are breaking up families coming across, because that's happening just as often, if not more often, than what's being talked about is the breakup once they get here, Jeremy.
Sheriff, where you are in Larimer County, Colorado, there is the city of Fort Collins. And last year, the city council approved a resolution to clarify that police cannot ask residents about their immigration status unless that information is required by law. Fort Collins has stopped short of becoming a sanctuary city. But what do you think about that vote?
You know, it's very bizarre, Jeremy, because in there, the city still allows employees who are in charge of giving out some sort of a benefit to ask those questions. But a police officer is forbidden. And if you read what they put into their rules, it said in there, if they believe a police officer without authorization asked that question, they could be disciplined up to and including termination. I think that's absolutely outrageous. The reality is when you're investigating things like human trafficking, there's times you're going to pose that question when a witness or a victim is not cooperating or maybe is giving you some bad information. It may be very legitimate to pose the question about their status, because that could explain at times why the individual is not being forthcoming. And it also provides the opportunity for that individual to learn about U visas and T visas that can protect victims of certain classes of crime. So again, the city of Fort Collins chose to politicize something that I think is actually runs the risk of backfiring and creating more victims of local crime because of that decision.
Well, one of the councilwomen who was involved in that decision, that measure, voted for it, said that she didn't want people to feel afraid to report crimes to the police, and that they would if they thought that they were going to be asked about their immigration status.
Well, again, I know that to be a false narrative. The people who are actually planting that fear, interestingly enough, are those who pose as immigration advocates. They are the individuals, I've talked to them, they run out to the community and tell the citizens, be afraid of the police, be afraid to call because they're going to have you deported. The reality is, I've challenged them, you know about U visas, you know about T visas. If you want to be an advocate, explain that to individuals, and also face the reality of when was the last time a victim or a witness to a local crime was deported based on their cooperation with the local police. So I think they do a great disservice. They're politicizing this issue with a vulnerable group.
We're talking here primarily about people who are crossing the southern U.S. border illegally. It turns out, though, according to the Center for Migration Studies, that two-thirds of the people who are in this country illegally have overstayed their visas. Why not have more of a focus on that?
Well, you know, the reality is I'm not necessarily talking about those who simply came across illegally. I'm talking about anyone who's in violation of any federal laws. There's a lot of things that can be done better. Number one, on the enforcement of those who come here under some sort of a visa or come legally into our country but overstay, we need to do a better job. The immigration system needs to do a better job with that, and we need to provide more security on our borders.
I want to ask you one more thing, Sheriff. Let's listen here to President Trump. When he was announcing his candidacy back in 2015, he said when Mexico sends people to the U.S., they're not sending their best.
They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
So that was what he said when he was starting his candidacy. He said just recently he called some people animals, then later said that he was just talking about gang members. But what do you think about the language? Is that okay with you when he uses terms like that, or do you think he should tone it down?
In fairness, Jeremy, I think, you know, to roll back on any president, on any politician, on any member of the public and take a small piece from a couple of years ago, that's trying to drill down and sidetrack the issue. The reality is we do not have secure borders in this country. We have a lot of citizens of other countries who are being brought across and victimized. And until we secure those borders, that's going to continue to happen. Until we set up a system that puts appropriate punishment on those who illegally employ individuals that shouldn't be here, until we set up a system that does allow for those businesses who have a need and want to follow the rules to bring people in and return them for temporary labor, until those things are fixed, we're going to continue to have problems. So I think to narrowly focus on any part of this does it a great injustice. You would acknowledge this is a pretty broad issue.
Absolutely. And yet for many years, the solutions have not come very quickly to it. It's just we'll see what happens this year. That's Larimer County, Colorado Sheriff Justin Smith. Sheriff, thank you for joining us and sharing your views.
Thank you, Jeremy.
There may be a rival suitor for the assets that 21st Century Fox is selling to Disney. Comcast announced today that it's preparing an offer worth more than the current bid from Disney for a collection of 21st Century Fox properties, including Fox's film and TV studio, regional sports network, some cable channels, and a stake in Hulu. It's not only a higher bid. If Comcast goes ahead with the offer, it would be all cash. Well, joining us now is Charisse Jones of USA Today. Hi there, Charisse.
Hello.
So Comcast, which also owns NBC Universal, is saying that no final decision has been made on this. But what details do we know about the potential deal thus far?
Yeah, Comcast is saying that it is seriously considering making a bid that would be all cash and top an agreement that was tentatively entered into between Disney and Fox that would be worth about $52 billion. So it's kind of thrown a wrench in something that was kind of proceeding at full speed.
I see. Now, does the all cash aspect of this make a difference?
It makes a difference in terms of who Fox wants to go with in terms of these two suitors, because all cash carries a tax liability that the all stock offer from Disney does not, even though the value is significantly higher with Comcast's offer.
Mm. Now, government regulators have raised concerns about a different merger, AT&T Time Warner. I mean, this one is another potential giant media merger. Would either company be more likely, I mean, Comcast versus Disney, to get the government to sign off on the deal?
Yeah, Disney might have a harder time because they already own ESPN. And if they get these regional Fox networks that focus on sports along with FX and some of these other properties, there might be concern that they could push up the cable rates that people pay and that that's too much power that's concentrated in that one entity. So they might have a slightly harder road to go in terms of their competition with Comcast.
Mm. Now, we know that more people are using streaming services such as Netflix and that legacy cable channels, maybe they're losing viewers over time. And this seems like obviously to be an almost inevitable trend with technology. I mean, what does the fact that there's competition over this deal signal about the media industry overall?
You know, it means that content is king. You've got all of these old school traditional companies that are trying to stay in the game and they're trying to corral as many sources of content, high quality content that they can find so that they can compete in this new streaming landscape. I mean, Netflix has 100 million paying subscribers around the world. And so you've got to, you know, get in that space. Netflix has the new deal with the Obamas and Shonda Rhimes. And so this is really the future of where people are going for their entertainment.
I mean, I'm seeing here that 21st Century Fox owns about 30% of Hulu. Disney and Comcast each have 30%. So regardless of who gets it, Disney or Comcast, the new merged company would have a controlling stake, right?
That's right. They would own at least 60% of Hulu, which is another streaming service. And so it would make them a much better competitor when it comes to Amazon and Apple and Netflix. And so that's why this is so important to both of those companies.
Wow. And a huge price tag. So content is absolutely king. Charisse Jones of USA Today, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
It's time now for a jazz edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Bo Leibowitz is a DJ for KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He's back with us once again. Hi, Bo.
Hi, Jeremy.
And the name of your show, by the way, is Strictly Jazz, which makes me wonder, is the genre of jazz getting too wild and you've got to make sure you're staying to what's considered strictly jazz?
Well, actually, the derivation of the name stems from the fact that the station is known for its eclectic qualities, the flagship show being
Morning Becomes Eclectic. Right.
So it was more, and I didn't even choose the name, it was something before me, but it was to distinguish it because everything else is eclectic, so we wanted to let them know this is just strictly jazz.
Okay, well, let's get to some of the jazz. This is the German-born pianist Monika Herzig with 4CC. So tell us about this one.
It's written by the bass player, Jennifer Vincent. In fact, the name of the disc is She Rose, and it's an all-female band. But what I like about this particular track for CC is that it has two pairs of instruments that introduce the song. First, the bass and the piano sort of work in tandem to provide the rhythmic backdrop, and there's a sort of sense of urgency about their entrance. And then you have the flute and the trombone, which state the melody, which is rather fragmented, in unison, and then they solo over each other. So it's, I don't know, it has a very urgent feel to it that I find very satisfying.
And Monika Herzig is from Germany. She's now a professor at Indiana University. Tell us more about her.
Well, the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music is one of the finest in the country, and it was basically put together by the late David Baker, who died about a year or so ago. And in fact, Monica Herzig wrote a book about David Baker. So she's one of these people who wears many hats. She's a pianist, she's an educator, she's a writer, and she's a promoter as well.
All right, well, the next one you brought us is from Miles Davis and John Coltrane's album, The Final Tour. This is called Green Dolphin Street. It was performed live in Stockholm. Now, the final tour refers to a tour through Europe with both Davis and Coltrane, and Miles Davis wrote in his biography that John Coltrane grumbled and complained and sat by himself all the time we were over there. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, he was in the midst of forging his own career as a soloist and as a leader, and he really didn't want to go on this tour, and he and Miles had sort of, difficult relationships here and there. But they were perfect for each other. They were a great foil for each other. Miles was very contained and chose his notes carefully, and Coltrane just flooded the area with notes. I mean, he was known as sheets of sound. But anyway, Coltrane was preoccupied with his own career at the time. He had recorded Giant Steps, a monumental album for Atlantic. And this tune, Like Sonny, which was based upon a 10-second phrase that Sonny Rollins had played on a record. And you could tell that he was preoccupied. He had recorded it about 3 or 4 months before this recording of On Green Dolphin Street. And you can hear him sort of noodling around with that song that he had just recorded. And to me, it sort of epitomizes Train's position at this time in 1960 and wanting to stretch out a bit more.
Okay, well, up next, you have brought us the drummer Matt Wilson with his song Anywhere and Everywhere People.
There are people so near nothing, they are everywhere without being seen. There are people so eager to be seen, they nearly always manage to be seen. There are people who want to be everywhere at once, and they seem to get nowhere.
Would you call that singing or talking?
Oh, that's definitely talking, and oddly enough, the narrator there is perhaps the greatest bass player alive today, Christian McBride, although he does not perform on the bass here, but he is one of the many narrators that Matt Wilson has used to illuminate the poems of Carl Sandburg.
And in this song, we hear a straight rock and roll beat, not the normal swing you hear in jazz.
Right, right. There's a little bit of backbeat there, but I love the way that the music sort of syncs up with the poem, emphasizing certain words and syllables. For example, the trumpet and the saxophone emphasize the word everywhere, and so it gives it some structure.
They are everywhere without being seen.
And who is Matt Wilson?
Matt Wilson is a drummer from, I believe, the Midwest to begin with, but played with a lot of good people on the East Coast, Lee Konitz in particular, I remember, and he's a very good drummer.
We have time for one more. This is So Long by Melody Gardot.
Don't wait up for me, darling, I'm not coming home. Draw the blinds.
beautiful voice.
Oh, yes, I really like her voice. It's so sensuous, and she has this sort of natural vibrato with this very sensuous quaver to it that reels me in every time. And that song is sort of like a Dear John letter, and it comes from a series of recordings, I believe previously unreleased, of a tour in Europe that spanned from 2012 to 2016. And she, by the way, is sort of the poster child for music therapy because she was involved in a horrible hit-and-run accident while she was riding her bike. And she was in the hospital for many, many months. And it was very early in her career. She had never recorded before, but she had appeared in some nightclubs in Philadelphia. But it was in that hospital stay that she really got back into the music. And that became her EP. Her initial EP was from that period. And then she just took off from there. She's wonderful.
And this may be surprising to our listeners when you listen to her voice, but she's only 33 years old.
Yeah.
She sounds, I know. You know, she's like she's got an old soul.
Exactly. She sounds like she's been through it all.
Right. Well, that's Bo Leibowitz, who is a DJ for KCRW in Santa Monica. His show is Strictly Jazz. Bo, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Nice to be back.
Up to 50,000 hotel and casino workers in Las Vegas could go on strike next week. The powerful Culinary Workers Union voted yesterday to authorize the walkout when contracts expire at the end of May. Bartenders, housekeepers, bellmen, and line cooks rallied yesterday before the vote. The union is demanding better pay, but it's also asking for protections against the use of robots and artificial intelligence to automate service jobs. This would be the first major strike in more than 30 years, and it could slow down Las Vegas' multi-billion dollar tourism industry. Bethany Kahn is spokeswoman for the Culinary Workers Union in Las Vegas. Bethany, welcome.
Thanks.
So first of all, 25,000 union workers in Las Vegas voted yesterday. 99% of them approved the authorization to strike. Why is there so much support amongst union members there?
Workers are planning to go on strike after June 1st to protect their livelihoods, to protect their good union jobs that have fair wages, health benefits, and job security. And so negotiating a new five-year contract is really important for our economy and for the community.
Now, let's talk about one of the specific demands the union is calling for, and that's protection against automation at hotels and casinos in Las Vegas. I mean, what kind of things have you been seeing at resorts that are bringing robots or artificial intelligence into the work that union members are doing?
There's robot concierge front desk robots. There are, you know, automation has impacted kitchens over the years. We know that technology is coming, and we believe that the casino company should ensure technology is harnessed to improve the quality in the workplace and enhance the customer and guest experience, and not as a way to completely eliminate jobs.
Let me ask you a little bit more about that because, I mean, as you said, you're right. Technology is coming into every workplace here. So I'm wondering, is the union demanding more protections from technology, or is this an opportunity in the contract negotiations to ask employers to maybe provide more training for union members to assist them to transition as the workplace changes?
Yeah, this is a way to grow with technology. We think technology can be supportive in the workplace. It could be safety buttons for guest room attendants and workers who are work alone. It could be motorized carts so that workers don't have to push heavy carts by themselves. So technology is coming and it can be assistive and supportive. And so with this contract language, we would have a voice. Workers would have a voice in how technology is implemented. There would be job training if technology changes our jobs. Maybe we're doing different things. Ultimately, if, you know, jobs aren't able to be saved and there's layoffs, then there's a severance package and then there's an order of which layoffs occur.
Worker safety is also a significant issue that the union is talking about. I mean, you're looking for more protections against sexual harassment specifically. How big of an issue is that in Las Vegas for hotel workers?
I think that sexual harassment's a big issue for women around the world for centuries. And so, you know, after the Me Too movement, we've been really grappling with how to make the workplace safer. And what are some of the things that we can do with the company because it's under a union contract? So some of that is the safety buttons for workers who, you know, work alone, work at night, and then making sure that there is a zero tolerance policy for guests and high rollers who are abusive. And employees always do their best to provide quality service, and we think they shouldn't have to endure harassment or worse from guests who think that they can abuse the workers just because they're on vacation.
Mm. Now, MGM Grand told us today that the vote yesterday, that they expected it as part of the negotiation process, essentially that the union is looking for leverage as negotiations go forward. Is that what this is about?
It's very rare for us to have a citywide strike vote. We've only held it once before in 2002. And the reason why there was no strike in 2002 is because the company settled the next day. But taking a strike, voting to go on strike with your family and your babies in tow with you, that's a really serious step. And a strike is a last resort. It means a huge amount of sacrifice. It means, you know, that you're putting everything on the line. And it's a huge amount of sacrifice. So we workers don't take this lightly. The union doesn't take it lightly. Many of us have been on strike before, and it's brutal. It's really hard.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because to that point, yeah. I mean, the last culinary union strike was in 1984. It went for 67 mm-hmm. days. It cost millions of dollars, right? I mean, to the hotels, the casinos, and to workers in the form of lost wages. So, I mean, if this strike does go ahead and it goes on for a long period of time, I mean, how is the union preparing to deal with the fact of those lost wages?
So we have 9 more days to figure out a contract, and we're hopeful the companies will settle so that we don't have to call for a strike. The culinary union hasn't called for a strike yet. We're just saying that now we've been authorized to call for a strike after June 1st when the contracts expire for 50,000 workers. And so that will impact the economy if there is a strike.
Well, Bethany Kahn is spokeswoman for the Culinary Workers Union, whose hotel and casino workers have voted to authorize a strike in Las Vegas as soon as next week. Bethany, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.